The TNT Shop has great gift ideas for your furry family member. And we don't mean your Aunt Dolores.
You stink!
The TNT Shop has it all. At TNTRadio.live. Speaking on the issues that impact, this is the Patrick Henningsen Show on TNT Radio.
All right, everybody, welcome. Welcome, everybody, to this glorious Monday here on TNT. Today's news talk, and I promised you last week that this week was going to be a scorcher in terms of news. We just felt it instinctively. We felt the tsunami coming, and certainly it's delivered once again. So we are going to hit some of these big stories in the next couple of hours. And we're also going to be joined by some friends of the show, some special guests, including our research assistant, Miles of Truth. Very pleased that Miles will be joining us in the first hour. In the second hour, also, we're going to hear from, there's more stuff breaking we need to get a grip on at the Southern District of New York federal court with Matt Lee, and also at the UN as well. And there's more even than that, and Matt will be able to share with us. We're going to connect with him in the second hour, and looking forward to that. Had a very spirited discussion with Matthew on Friday, and certainly we got some breaking stories on the FTX-SBF scandal, things that you would only know if you listen to this show or you read Inner City Press closely. So we're very happy to be working with someone like Matt on these stories and really getting you the breaking sort of inside details as they come literally out of the courtroom that day or that hour. That's what we're able to do on this program. Now, in terms of big stories, big programs, yeah, it's a big program, big stories. You know, the desperation is setting in with Ukraine, and this is when you know things are getting desperate. And if you understand the NATO playbook on wars, you know, the amount of money that NATO countries plowed into Syria over a 10-year period, and they're still spending there, by the way, they're still spending trying to sort of prop up the new Islamic State, literally an Islamic State, Idlib. It's an Al-Qaeda state. And NATO is still spending money propping it up. And it, over that 10-year period, mainly we're talking about 2011 to 2020, 21, the amount of weapons, cash, all sorts of stuff, you know, plowed into Syria, mainly into Turkey and into the Islamic extremist provinces like Idlib and some of the other, and also the sort of fake Syrian Kurdish enclave that the West is trying so hard to carve a piece out of northeastern Syria. But tons and tons of money. And they thought that was going to be done and dusted in 2013. They had the jihadi arms airlift going. They were sending tons, thousands of tons, literally, of weapons via Croatia and other sort of different routes into Syria and flooding it with terrorists as far as, you know, Uyghurs, all the way, even like bringing 30,000 Uyghurs in via Turkey into northern Syria. I mean, that's what was going on, and all around the Gulf, as usual. Then ISIS came. And so everyone knows that story really well. But what they don't know is that at every point, every strategic point, where the NATO-backed terrorists in Syria were about to lose or lose a sort of really pivotal strategic area like East Ghouta, Douma, or Khan Shahoun, or up in sort of, you know, northwestern Syria, there would always be, almost by magic, a staged chemical weapons provocation. And of course, the global media would rally very quickly and then, you know, use NATO cutout organizations or fake open source intelligence, independent, whatever. Bellingcat is a good example. That's basically a tool of NATO that's meant to look like it's independent. And then they feed the Times and the New York Times and all these Western outlets with their independent intelligence about Syria. And they did this to try to create a narrative that Syria was just when Syria was winning that they'd get desperate and somehow throw out a chemical weapon, a chlorine bomb or some other sort of mythical WMD. And they'd fabricate the evidence. They'd even use CGI. It's what the New York Times was doing. Forensic architecture, using CGI to prove the case that Syria dropped a chlorine bomb on a building, and then somehow that magically killed all these people. And all of this stuff was being debunked by the independent media. And then, of course, those people debunking the official chemical weapons narrative were being attacked and called conspiracy theorists, the usual stuff. But the point is this: when NATO gets desperate, they have to stage a fake WMD provocation or shoot down an airliner. We'll get to that later, in order to change the sort of calculus on the ground and create a disruption or the pretext for an airstrike or some kind of, something that would be a game changer in terms of the battlefield on the ground. And right now, Ukraine is getting its butts kicked in dramatic fashion. And I'm not saying that flippantly. It's really bad. It's past the point of demanding a ceasefire at this point. A ceasefire needs to happen. Otherwise, it's just going to be carnage. But Washington is telling Kiev, Boris Johnson's being flown in to say, keep going, keep going, keep throwing your soldiers into this meat grinder. Keep going, lose another 100,000. Keep going. That's what Boris Johnson's saying to Kiev. And they're saying, don't worry, we'll give you billions more in cash and lots of weapons. And even if you lose the war, I'm paraphrasing what I think is being said, but they're almost like saying, look, we're going to pay you and reward you handsomely, whether you win or lose. That's what I believe is happening. But anyway, it's going really badly. And so what happened, and this is the same thing that happened in Syria, that when, and Russia's wise to this because they're on the front line with the situation in Syria for so long, they learned all of NATO's games on fake chemical weapons. And in some cases, the NATO-backed terrorists, or what they'd call the moderate rebels in Syria, would use actual chemical weapons in the field and then kill civilians with it and then try to blame Damascus for it. This happened more than once. And then they make a big kerfuffle with the UN inspectors. In some cases, they had to fabricate evidence using couriers or the white helmets or chemical weapons experts, middlemen who were working for the British or the American military intelligence apparatus. But they had to fabricate the case. And in this case, it looks like Ukraine's been caught in advance. And you have to remember, what's left of the Ukrainian military, not all the brightest bulbs in the box, if you know what I mean. And some of them have gotten a little bit cocky on social media, sort of released videos recently and kind of gave the game away. Tables full of chemical weapons compounds, okay, munitions. Okay, big faux pas, but you know, these guys are not the smartest, granted. Okay, we understand that. What Russia's found now is evidence that they've used these chemical weapons in the field to try to kill Russian troops in the Donbass. Or more specifically, former Ukrainian residents living in the Donetsk and Luhansk People's Republics who are with the defense forces there. They used to be Ukrainian for a few years ago. They're not anymore. They gained independence. If anyone earned independence, these people did. 8 years of siege from a NATO-backed Ukrainian military structure. Nonetheless, that's what's happening. And it's very interesting. So Russian military commanders are basically publicizing the evidence they have, including reports that Ukrainian troops have deployed a type of chemical weapons being used by those forces, NATO-backed forces, armed by NATO, with NATO special forces embedded within platoons and battalions of the Ukrainian military using chemical weapons. That's the allegations, basically. And, you know, putting this together with the sort of boasting on social media of these sort of dodgy Ukrainian units bragging about their chemical weapons stocks, it's a pretty damning case. So this is an interesting thing. Dmitry Peskov, he's the spokesperson for the Kremlin, declined to discuss the allegations with journalists very much. In other words, didn't go into grave detail, saying his office didn't have accurate information on the issue yet. But it seems like there's some of this going on. And so my guess is that, understanding how this worked in Syria, my guess is that the Ukrainian forces will be supplied with a certain illegal chemical or banned munitions. They'll use them in the field, ideally against civilians. And then the film teams, the crews will clean up crews or whatever, go in and film it, or they'll do whatever it takes. But the chemical weapons gag has worked so many times on the Western media that most people will fall for it. Because let's face it, folks, let's not mince words here. Western media consumers are among the most gullible on the planet, if not the most gullible on the planet. You could say that Putin teamed up with the Martians and deployed a space saucer, and they could probably airbrush photographs, CGI Putin with some Mars attack style aliens coming down the steps of some flying saucer. And there's a large percentage of Western media consumers that would probably believe it, because that's just what they do. Our media is so good at spinning these yarns, and Hollywood's involved as well. A lot of the white helmets, probably Sean Penn's probably on the ground making this film as we speak. Honestly, folks, I'm not making it up. They made it up. I didn't write the playbook. They wrote the playbook. Okay. I'm just commenting on things that have been done previously. The most ridiculous staged WMD scenes, the most ridiculous. I mean, why not go back to the Iraq model, which was fine? You know, don't even stage it. Don't even show it. Just say they have it. And then they can go and invade and bomb and, you know, do whatever they want, and they don't even need to show any evidence. Don't even need to fabricate a film. You know, making propaganda films is messy. Why should NATO get involved with that? Just say they have WMDs, box of WMDs, and they needed a preemptive strike. Just lie about it. It's much easier. So I'm being over the top facetious here, but of course, if you listen to the show, you know exactly my mood. Hopefully, we're going to link up with our old friend Miles of Truth and see what he's got to shine a light on this week. I'm Patrick Hanks, your host. We'll be right back.
TNT Radio's Jesse Zurawell.
The latest round of proposed amendments to the international health regulations, which were very concerning for many reasons, one of them being the clause about human dignity was canceled out. What is most concerning to you at this point in time?
In simplistic form, the most concerning nature of it is the secrecy behind it. It is still not available on the WHO website. They've submitted their final report on the proposed amendments to the Director General that would have given him a little bit of time to then notify the 194 member nations of the existence of that final report, which is required, according to the international health regulations, a four-month advanced notice prior to the yearly World Health Assembly. Last year, they kept the document secret until April 12th. And that is just absolutely not acceptable. Where's the damn document?
Jesse Zurawell on today's News Talk, TNT Radio.
This is a message for the parents of young children in the United States. I am Dr. Tess Laurie from the World Council for Health. Please consider the danger of vaccinating your children and babies with the COVID-19 injections. They are not the same as traditional vaccines and are causing significant harm to children around the world. Your children have their whole lives ahead of them. They are not endangered by COVID at all. Please hear us when we say, for your children, it is much safer to wait. Thank you.
Patrick Henningsen and TNT.
Here we go. We're into the first hour. Thank you for rejoining us on this live broadcast here on TNT, today's News Talk. And before the break, we were talking about this ugly specter of the chemical weapons narrative. It's starting to kind of rear its head in Ukraine. Now, the West really talked about this. They pushed this back in March a year ago. They said that, oh, Putin's going to get desperate. He's going to use chemical weapons because he used them in Syria. Literally, our media would just make up a whole narrative. They'll even make up a backstory that never happened, i.e. Russia was using chemical weapons in Syria. It never happened, but that shouldn't, you know, restrict the Western mainstream media from saying it, because and all the bevy of experts that tend to come on and comment on these things when they decide they're going to run with this talking point. So it looks like Russia's kind of caught them off guard a little bit early on this and preempted the narrative, as they say in the press, getting out front of the story. So what Russia's done here, I think it's because they got a lot of experience in Syria on this. And on the line right now, let me bring in Miles of Truth, our research assistant for the show. Miles, Welcome to the show, by the way. Thank you for joining us. And what are your feelings at the moment on Ukraine? Just a casual assessment, you know, from your vantage point.
Well, to be honest, I feel like I have difficulty keeping up with the day-to-day developments as they come. But yes, overall, I mean, I think we called it from the beginning, you know. I see this as a sort of geopolitical dream of NATO and the West to sort of move into Eurasia and sort of try and take over, shall we say. And I see everything sort of through that lens. The fact that there's now chemical weapons being brought up, I mean, I you can't help but think back to Syria immediately, because that was so recent and so laughable, shall we say. I mean, I feel like we helped, 21st Century Wire anyway, helped expose a lot of those events as staged. And, you know, I just expect more of the same. And if you look at what's been going on foreign policy-wise with regards to that issue, the chemical weapons issue, this is just more of the same. You know, going back to, you know, weapons of mass destruction allegations against Saddam Hussein back in 2002 or whatever that was. They keep accusing it, but really, you know, who are the people who've really used the worst weapons? Go back to Hiroshima and the use of Agent Orange and all that stuff. That was, I think it's been more used by the West than anybody else.
Yeah, that's true. That's true. And they've also sold those weapons to other people that have used them as well to make matters worse. But, you know, on the big scale of things, how do you think we're 1 year into the Ukraine, I would say, proxy war at this point? How does this stack up in terms of the, you know, the significance with Iraq and Afghanistan? Because those kind of happened right next to each other. You know, 2001, 2003, long occupations, but that kind of, like, you know, that was a real focus, wasn't it, of geopolitics for so many years. How about this situation? Do you think this is going to be the same, or less, or bigger?
I see it as more sort of to the point, more vital, shall we say. Whereas with Iraq and Libya and some of those Middle Eastern countries that fell to regime change, and there were other things like the Arab Spring that sort of played into it all. I kind of, like I said, I see this through this geopolitical lens where it's really the Eurasian landmass, which is the great prize, and some of those other countries. Yes, they were important sort of pieces on the map, but they weren't Russia. Russia's really got to be one of the grand prizes and one of the ones they've sort of spent decades trying to figure out how to get in there. So I really see it as more direct to be going against Ukraine in terms of you know, a possible future attempt to go further into Eurasia. I don't know if that makes sense to you.
Yeah, it does, and I'll raise the ante a little bit on that, Miles. The other country that they've been for a good part of it, you know, half a century plus, is Iran. wanting to get into Iran, overthrow the Islamic Revolutionary Government. And that's a really key note on the Eurasian landmass too. And Iran, with that close relationship with Russia, and you have that potential, you know, trading bridge there between the Middle East and Russia and Eastern Europe, that's pretty important on the geopolitical chessboard. It's been important, quite frankly, for centuries. So that's kind of coming into focus now. It seems like there's more, I feel like, Miles, it's more likely we're going to see direct conflict between the U.S. or its allies in Iran before we'll actually see direct conflict with Russia or China. What are your thoughts on that?
Wasn't there something about Israel doing a direct attack in Iran?
Yeah,
in the past few days.
Yep, they keep floating that out consistently, and I'm telling people, pay attention closely, because whatever Israel does to Iran, it will invariably pull in the United States if Iran retaliates. You see, so then it's on basically at that point. So that's why you got to be we got to be wary of that happening. That's, to me, really extremely dangerous.
Yeah, but no, obviously it goes without saying, if the shoe was on the other foot and it was Iran attacking Israel, we wouldn't be hearing the end of it.
No, of course not.
There would be just utter outrage. But I don't see a whole lot of coverage of this.
No, you won't. You won't.
No.
Yeah, especially with the new Netanyahu regime. Israel's done a really good job at sort of, you know, battening down the hatches on its public relations and its media. And just as they were losing ground, you remember the Squad, you had the one useful thing I think the Squad were doing, at least were sort of raising that issue. I'm talking about AOC and Rashida Tlaib and Ilhan Omar and all these guys, raising the issue of Palestine. So at least it's on the radar. And they do have a lot of support, a lot of Bernie supporters, you know, that end of the left wing. They're very much, you know, on that issue. However, they're up against, you know, a formidable opponent, you know, i.e. most of the Democrat and Republican Party are, you know, don't regard Palestine as a legitimate country or people. So they're very much aligned with the Israeli lobby on that, as is most of the U.S. media, as is Hollywood, and pretty much everybody else, for the most part, anyway. So that leaves the door open for some of this stuff to really kind of get traction in terms of, you know, right now there's a big demonization campaign with Iran. You've got the hijab controversy, you know, before Christmas, the woman who died in custody, supposedly the story is, anyway, the narrative is that she died in custody because she took her headscarf off. That's the simple narrative that more or less is consensus reality across the West. And now Hollywood's doing all these emotional ads about women's rights. So this is like Afghanistan in a way. You know, they're going to liberate the women. This is why we're bombing, and we got to, you know, put the Taliban down. And that's more or less the same. It works, Miles. That for a good part of the Western electorate, they'll buy into that as a reason to kind of get behind the war, as it were. So that's why I think this is quite a dangerous time, because when you see this, these sort of campaigns ramping up, plus, like you said, the hostile words of Israel towards Iran, and I think we're heading into a danger zone here.
Yeah, I do sense this is very dangerous, but I thought it was dangerous back in 2014, when, you know, the whole Maidan business happened. I thought that was unbelievably dangerous. Couldn't believe what I was seeing at the time. I certainly didn't imagine, you know, it would escalate to the point we're at now, you know, talking about Ukraine.
Ukraine,
it's unbelievable.
It's been the ultimate boiling frog, hasn't it? This Ukrainian situation. Who could imagine we'd be where we're at right now on this? Just, you know, what was it? Maidan, 8 years ago? And 9 years ago? 9 years ago.
Yeah, indeed.
9 years ago. Wow. time flies, but it's been one long, painful stretch for the people there, that's for sure. We think there's a lot of stuff breaking at the moment on this. So obviously we're going to try to stay on top of it and let our listeners know what we think is really happening. There's a couple of good interviews with Douglas McGregor and Scott Ritter up at 21stCenturyWire.com. Hat tip to Judge Napolitano for doing a good job of keeping up to date on those issues. We posted those two back-to-back interviews from Judging Freedom up at 21stCenturyWire.com. So I encourage listeners to go there if you want to sort of get what we think is more of a level-headed assessment of the military situation on the ground in Ukraine, totally diametrically opposed to what you're reading in the Washington Post, New York Times, or the Times of London, or the BBC, or anybody else. So we're just throwing it out there, and we'll let you be the judge what you think's who you think are the credible sources on this. But back on switching gears, Miles, you know, I had a really interesting conversation on Friday with the journalist Jackie DeVoy, who really did a wonderful job in the documentary film called A Good Death, exposing the midazolam and the euthanasia issue in the UK, how COVID was used as a sort of cloak to kind of fast track some of these, you know, what you might call official or unofficial euthanasia procedures. In this case, the Liverpool Pathway stroke NHS sort of program on that, and how the media just glossed it all over because COVID, right? It's like, don't ask questions. There's a pandemic on. Our frontline workers are doing their best and they're working extra shifts and get outside with your pot and pans and clap for the NHS every Friday. No one wanted to probe any of this stuff. And that was her story. So she went and ran with the story herself. She's a mainstream journalist. So the stuff in Canada, Miles, to me is even more shocking. Because they're not even using COVID as the kind of, you know, the cover for it. But have you looked into that very much?
Yeah. Well, it's to a degree, yes. That is what one of the things I wanted to talk about today. So it's pretty fortuitous, I think, that you did have that discussion on Friday with Jackie. And indeed, midazolam is actually one of the drugs they use I can't think of any other word except execute these deaths in Canada. I think there's a series of drugs, but midazolam is one of them that they're using to take people's lives. But yes, the program in Canada is called MAID, M-A-I-D, Medical Assistance in Dying. It's been going for a couple of years, but there's been changes recently where it's the definitions used or the situations it can be applied to have been widened somewhat. It started out for just terminal illness. And specifically did not include mental illness or disabilities as a cause to, you know, have your doctor basically, take your life. And this is different than this is true euthanasia. It's different than doctor-assisted suicide, which is when the doctor basically hands you the syringe and you do it yourself. This is actually the doctors taking your life themselves.
Before Miles, I just want to ask you this before you continue, Miles. Before, there were those cases where people were really suffering from stage 4 cancer, really excruciatingly painful, fatal, chronic stroke, fatal conditions whereby it was almost seen as I hate to use this term, a mercy killing. But you're saying that they've extended the remit now in Canada where we're not even talking about those types of extreme cases. These are just people that, for whatever reason, depression or difficult life socioeconomic circumstances might opt for this type of an exit. Is that what it is?
That's right. There's the bill that that permits this has been amended. I believe the changes don't come into effect fully until next month. But yes, from next month, mental illness alone will be grounds to apply for this, where you can just say, hey, I'm depressed, I want to die, and they, you know, presumably a doctor would inject you with these deadly cocktail of drugs and take your life. And in fact, we have seen, there has been some press of people who have sort of come up against this. There was a case of this lady, Christine Gauthier, that made news, I think it was a month or two back. And she's a former Paralympian and retired Canadian military. And she, I guess she's in a wheelchair, and was having trouble getting up and down her stairs. And she was trying to get government support to install a wheelchair ramp in her house. And, you know, when the, instead of giving her the wheelchair, they offered to take her life, which must have been quite a surprise, I would have thought, for someone like that.
It sounds very cynical that the state would offer that, Miles. I mean, from a cynic, I would say the state's trying to go for the cheaper option in terms of what they would have to pay out. I mean, it does look like that, Miles, that that's what's going on.
It does look like it's an easy option. Instead of providing lots of expensive care and, you know, tough decisions in terms of people's health care, it's a one-stop shop. You can take care of all the problems of this person and get them out of your hair all at once.
Here's the danger, Miles. If the state's involved and it's being paid for, like through a national health type situation, then what happens if the state would, you know, pay for a psychologist or a psychiatrist or somebody, a counselor, and then that counselor might steer the person towards that as an option early on in the process of how they engage with the health system, and they're steering them towards that. And while they're in a vulnerable, you know, position psychologically, emotionally, and stuff. That's to me, Miles, that's what scares me, is because we've seen this with the gender transition stuff with the kids. Kids are very vulnerable at 13, 14, 15, emotionally, physically, puberty, etc. And these counselors paid for by the state are literally pushing them into gender reassignment. And that's the part that I think is that would accelerate this problem, I think.
Yeah, I mean, there's another case I read about, a man named Rod McNeil, who was, in fact, euthanized. He was killed by the doctors. And the reason they gave was that because he had end-stage COPD, where, you know, they made it sound like he was on his last legs and, you know, was about to die at any moment. Or, you know, was in a lot of suffering right before his death. But when they did, they autopsied his body after they took his life, and they found he didn't even have that condition. So what you're saying there about it being applied where maybe it shouldn't be, I do think there's a clear danger of that. It's probably already going that way, and especially now that they're widening the definition to not just, it's called irreversible conditions. And I think that includes not only terminal illnesses, but also disabilities and mental illnesses. So just, you know, maybe not being able to, I don't know, whatever disability you can think of, whether you don't have your legs or, you have a mental condition or whatever it could be, I'm sure they could come up with grounds to put you up for this program. And now it's to the point where the figures are 10,000 people are dying this way every year in Canada. with the thing that really caught my attention, the reason I wanted to talk about this is there was a Daily Mail article I saw a few weeks ago where they were, some of these doctors were actually, their whole tone was a bit too happy about this. It was shocking where this article actually said they're joyful and that this is the most rewarding work they've ever done. And
God,
how they're happily taking lives left and right. One doctor has euthanized 400 people, including somebody who was deemed incapable of choosing that option. And she went ahead and did it anyway. So, and there was another doctor in that article who'd been party to 300 of these deaths. So some of these doctors, I mean, it's kind of analogous to abortion in a way where, to me, like, okay, maybe there's an argument to be made for abortion in a lot of circumstances, but isn't it wrong to be like ecstatic about it and overjoyed? I find that just something wrong there.
Yeah, the gleefulness that's
The gleefulness, to me it tells me there's something else going on. And if I had to guess, I'd say this is part of a part of a eugenics sort of
100%.
It's part of a giant eugenics program, which we're experiencing on the COVID front, but also here and with certain other things.
If anything ticks the boxes for eugenics, this whole thing does, like almost just perfectly. And that's not a good thing. Look, I got a couple more. We got a couple more angles. We're gonna pull on this one after the break, but I'm here with Miles of Truth. We're talking about the big story, Canada's overenthusiasm for euthanasia. We'll just leave it there, and we'll pick it up on the other side. I'm Patrick Hengson, your host. You're listening to TNT, Today's News Talk. We'll be right back.
With his expert analysis and opinion, this is TNT Radio's Timothy Shea.
Bye-bye, Baron!
Or Pop Goes the Weasel.
After an embarrassing 5 days in which the feckless Biden administration allowed a Chinese spy balloon to transit the continental United States, an F-22 today was ordered to take the balloon down with a Sidewinder missile to the payload over the ocean so that no forensically useful wreckage could be recovered. Sounds like the big guy is taking his orders from an even bigger guy. Well, 10% to the big guy definitely came with strings attached, didn't it? And here they all come now. Oh, there were 3 balloons under the Trump administration, and there was a balloon under the Biden administration a couple years ago. It's not a big deal. Well, we're thinking it is a big deal, and we're thinking Republicans in Congress had better look into it. From MAGAInstitute.com, this is Timothy Shea for TNT Radio.
When it comes to vaping, the truth can get clouded. So let's make it clear. Vaping is not safe for youth.
Because vaping can put microscopic particles into your lungs.
And dangerous things like metals into your body.
And nicotine, which can harm a person's brain development through their mid-20s.
With appealing flavors, high nicotine levels, and lots of promotion on social media.
Many kids think vaping is harmless, but it's not.
So talk to your kids about the risks of vaping.
Because when you talk, they hear you.
Learn more at underagedrinking.samhsa.gov.
This is the Patrick Henningsen Show on TNT Radio.
All right, welcome back. Welcome back. We're closing out the first hour here with Miles of Truth, our research assistant for the show. And before the break, Miles and I were discussing this. It's increasingly disturbing, the story out of Canada, the euthanasia issue. It's become almost a preferred option in some cases for some people, some doctors, some medical clinics and so forth that are set up for this type of work. And the problem here is, and we'll bring Miles back in on this. Miles, the problem that I see on this is that it's a automatic slippery slope, because, and I think COVID should have been the warning shot for everybody in the world, that if you create economic incentives, You start to create an industry around some kind of a disease or a condition or some kind of, you know, dare I say, socially driven medical procedure. I think there's a lot of politics and ideology involved in this. You mentioned eugenics before the break. I wholeheartedly agree on that. That's an old one that's always been very trendy among certain elite circles. But the slippery slope, Miles, is that whereby previously, when this was first introduced as medical-assisted suicide, there were certain conditions. It was seen, okay, this is too far, even for some countries that would only a few had made this illegal. I think there was, if I'm not mistaken, Belgium or the Netherlands and Switzerland, and maybe one other country that we know of that you could do that. And there are people flying in for that sort of thing. Okay, fair enough. It was limited, but as soon as you start to lower the baseline or the requirement for conditions to qualify for this type of procedure, that's the one. Here's the other one. Normally that's seen as people of maybe say older age groups who are, you know, suffering greatly and so forth. Again, we use the term mercy killing or mercy assisted suicide. What happens when they start invariably lowering the age whereby this is seen as an acceptable option? And how low does that go? And I will argue if it's ideologically driven and the state is given too much power, I think they could push it down quite low, you know, even to people in their late 20s. I know that sounds crazy and horrific, but I mean, how does it end? Where does it end on this? I think this is so much at the extreme end, Miles, of society.
Well,
there's no limits. But go ahead.
Yeah, on that note of, you know, pushing it to younger people. I mean, first, before you can do it, you sort of have to change public attitudes to be, you know, more accepting of it. And one of the things they're doing is they've published a children's book on this topic. It's a children's book aimed at kids 6 to 12 years old.
Oh, my God.
So it's sort of explaining why it's such a great thing to young kids to be killing people who I guess should die. I don't know how else to say it. That it just seems like I don't know that. You know, what I'm saying about public attitudes changing as well. I mean, that goes for the doctors as well. What happened to the Hippocratic Oath? Do no harm. There's a principle of sort of, I think it's called non-malfeasance, which is not only you should try to do good, but you try not to do any damage in the process of, you know, offering a remedy. And when the patient doesn't walk away from your treatment, that's not a good outcome. According to traditional medicine, you know, but now apparently it's okay. So there's been definitely a shift in sort of doctors' attitudes to be accepting this, I think.
Yeah. The problem, Miles, is if you go to medical school, I'm sure there's an ethics component to the med school curriculum, but how long do they spend on that? Is it one quarter or a semester? Is it one course? Is it maybe two courses and that's it? So it's already, I think I would wager, Miles, it's limited. And they're not going to cover medically assisted or euthanasia, suicide. They're not going to do it. And so I don't believe that maybe it's a specialist course in some med schools or something, but it's not going to be universally part of any curriculum. Therefore, the majority of doctors out there practicing right across all medicine, okay, they have no way of processing this. It's not in their calculus. So what? Well, it's being driven by what? Commercial interests at that point.
Yeah. I'm also, I should mention also there's a connection to another phenomenon here, which is organ harvesting.
Oh, no.
Apparently, there's a link here where, you know, these bodies being produced by this assisted dying is, you know, producing a lot of extra organs for, I don't know if they're being used in transplants or what, or just research.
Yeah, but, the multi-billion-dollar industry, Miles, multi-billion-dollar industry for transplants, stem cells, and research.
Yeah, so at this point, Canada is now the world leader in organ harvesting from people who choose assisted dying.
You're kidding me. This is a nightmare.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I always remember back to, Alex Jones used to bring up this clip of Bill Gates all the time. I don't know if you remember this, with Bill Gates up on some stage talking about death panels and, you know, I can't remember the exact quote, but it was something like, we could save this life, or we could kill this person and save all these other lives.
Yeah,
he's trying to make it sound like a trade-off. I mean, that's a very, I don't know, going back to what I was saying about public attitudes changing, I think that's what he was doing back then, and that was probably 10, 15 years ago.
Yeah, it's Logan's Run. It's that kind of halcyon, you know, it just becomes that sort of anesthetized, halcyon, emotionless, kind of not almost
calculation.
Yeah. But with this kind of pseudo gleeful kind of treatment of it, you know, like, oh, it's all for the greater good. It's all for the best. And
isn't Trudeau the perfect face man for this sort of fake liberal, you know, posing as this sort of, I don't know what he is, super woke, super like friendly prime minister guy.
He's pulled the wool
over. Really,
he's pulled the wool over the whole Canada's liberal left, which
I don't see this policy as liberal personally.
No. Well, they might argue that it is. They might argue that it is after they've after you've been beset upon by all these shrink psychiatrists and counselors to make you think that you've got this problem, that problem, you can't go on. The best option is, state assisted, Harry Caray. That might seem like the ultimate liberal option, you know, to those people's thinking. That's how twisted it is, Miles.
Well, actually, I believe the original law, there was a court decision first and then a law passed by the parliament in Canada. But the original court decision, I believe, was a court case by a civil rights group who were pushing for this, quote, right to die. So they did frame it as a sort of rights issue, civil rights, you know, ability to choose your death. In that respect, I guess it is liberal, but when you don't walk away from the treatment, like I said, I don't see that as as good medicine, personally.
No, I don't think so. I see a sort of Dr. Mengele result, maybe good, you know, like for Mengele's stats, what he was keeping in terms of records, all good, you know, bigger numbers and all that in that column. But what does this say? Here's the thing, Miles, and this is the point. I think this is a point, one of the main points we need to ask ourselves here when we're talking about a story like this. What does it say about society? And what does it say about the state or government in question where this type of a practice proliferates and is funded, is given resources, is helped to kind of, you know, develop? What does that say about that society and that state? And people make up society, but the government that they are, you know, allowing to govern them, and that's the stuff going on. What does it really say? Does it say that it's at the government or the system at the end of its usefulness cycle at that point? Is it an out of control fascist regime? It's definitely not the type of, you know, classic liberal democracy that we would have seen as a kind of a model, you know, in the 20th century, let's say. But what do you think about that question?
I think it's a sign that the leaders and decision makers in that society are eugenicists. That's what it says to me. If they're okay with this, I mean, this is eugenics.
So the question,
I don't see how anyone could say anything else.
But is it because they were eugenicists previously, or is it because they have become or increased the ranks of eugenicists? In other words, does the system make the eugenicist, or does the eugenicist make the system?
I'm not sure, but I mean, I mentioned Bill Gates before, his talking about death panels. He also happens to be the biggest owner of farmland, invested in all these fake meats and stuff. I mean, if you look, it all seems connected. Like this direction, eugenics, you can be separated into positive and negative, which is positive is like adding something to humanity, new features, let's say. Negative eugenics is removing the undesirable features by sort of removing those people from the gene pool you don't want. And I see this as more of a clear case of negative eugenics. Probably up there alongside abortion and, I don't know, not to be too, I don't want to get too political here, but yes.
So before, if it was just this type of thing was limited, this type of, you know, state-assisted euthanasia was limited to people with sort of, you know, major, you know, chronic, terminal condition and painful on the way out. Like any way you cut it, it's bad. Then all of a sudden, you know, as this thing develops and as it gets, the remit kind of opens up a little bit to interpretation. And let's say man with, you know, military vet, chronic back pain, hooked on Oxycontin opioids, and then hooked on the other medication to deal with that addiction, and a total manic depressive, right? And just a basket case, and homeless. And so he shows up to the clinic or to the counseling, and then they're pushing him towards this option, right? Because his life is irredeemable. He can't be rescued. Too many things wrong. He doesn't have the willpower to get through it. He may die in a crack heroin den on his own in a year or two anyway. I'm playing the state's devil's advocate here.
I'm sure they would consider a substance abuse problem to be a mental health issue, which would qualify you.
Which the same government is promoting the use of drugs. Canada, legalizing opioids, fentanyl, heroin, and a whole bunch of others, wanting to make a state to facilitate those the usage of all these things under some kind of a state aegis. You see where I'm going with this, Miles? You know, it's like they're creating the supply for the problem to feed their solution, you know?
Yeah, and the whole COVID era has probably produced a lot of people who were, you know, I don't know,
depressed,
have new problems,
yeah,
because of it.
Yeah, addiction.
Whether they lost their business or whatever, were stuck at home, that they were arguing with their wife more, all those issues. Social problems created.
Yeah, abuse issues.
By lockdowns, et cetera.
Totally.
It's going to provide fodder for this program.
Totally. And how did all those problems begin? They started with what? Government policy. Again, all roads lead back to the source of the problem. And here we go. The solution. what a nice, tidy solution for the progenitors and creators of the problem. Miles, a hugely important story. Thank you very much for bringing this to our attention. No doubt we're going to continue this discussion because this one's not going away. But thank you, Miles.
No worries. My pleasure, Patrick. Talk to you soon.
There he goes, ladies and gentlemen. Miles of Truth. Very important story. We're not going to let that one go. We'll continue to pick that one up because it's just developing. Look, top of the hour news headlines coming up. I'm Patrick Henningsen. Stick around. We'll be hitting some big stories on the other side, plus catching up in the next hour with Matthew Lee in the Southern District of New York. All this and more. Stick around.